Blog Talk Radio.
This is an Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash production.
Into another fantabulous episode of the Take It Easy Radio Show, coming to you live on Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash. It is another amazing, fantabulous week to close out this month of March. My name is Kyle, and I will be riding with you here for the next hour on Open Talk Radio. Hope everyone's doing great so far today, or whenever you're listening. Check us out on Instagram, Comical Sports Memes, and for now, Take It Easy Podcast, as well as following Open Talk Radio 313 The Flash everywhere that you get social media, Facebook, and Instagram, and check out the podcast everywhere it is that you get podcasts. We got a fun show planned for you today because snuck into the reef behind our last show on NBA trade deadline day last Thursday was a deal around the NFL with the 49ers, the Dolphins, and the Eagles all moving around in draft positioning. So we talked a bit about that on the podcast. We'll get to it a bit later on today. Also, a little bit of Final Four talk since this will be our last show here before we end up crowning a champion in college basketball. And by the way, for anyone who was watching that game yesterday between UCLA and Michigan, there seems to be a bit of a dispute about whether or not it was a great game or a bad game between Michigan and UCLA. Because I attest any game that scores 100 points from both teams combined is not a good college basketball game. They haven't been playing 51-49 college basketball games since like the early 1980s when there was no shot clock. So this one does appear to probably be in the camp of not a great college basketball game, but still, UCLA advanced. They made me look silly. I talked about that on today's podcast, which again, on Wednesday, or whenever you're checking this episode, you can find the Take It Easy podcast daily, wherever it is that you get podcasts. So we'll get to all of that going on throughout the rest of the show, but first, it's MLB opening day, ladies and gentlemen. Tomorrow is the day where MLB gets started first and foremost. If you want the full preview, if you want all of that lovely jazz that you can get, check out Thursday's Take It Easy podcast. But here, I genuinely don't want to do two season previews. So what I want to talk about here is literally MLB opening day, which is even shorter term than the grand scheme of things, because one game doesn't go towards anything in terms of Major League Baseball and how this season is going to play out. One game doesn't mean anything in terms of sample size, but opening day is a day to enjoy all that baseball has to offer, whether on TV, radio, ever it is that you're watching. Maybe you're going to be able to get into a ballpark. If you are, you lucky sons of guns, if you're able to get into a ballpark tomorrow for Major League Baseball opening day. But either way, there's going to be some really interesting stuff going on. And as the season gets underway, first of all, my San Diego Padres are, if not one of the three or four best teams in baseball, possibly the best team in Major League Baseball. For the first time in my memorable lifetime, the Padres have expectations. And expectation just feels weird to hear out loud, but the Padres have legitimate, real expectation going into the first game of the season. And this is really something that I'm excited about But of course, there's always this inferiority complex between San Diego, right? You're always battling up against LA, trying to punch up at the big dogs, et cetera, et cetera. We talked about this on Tuesday on the podcast with Rafe Cantor and Ben Stein. They made a podcast on the Chargers leaving for Los Angeles. There's this inferiority complex that exists within San Diego sports. And so it'll be interesting for the first time in my memorable lifetime to see genuine expectation going into a season for the Padres. And there'll be lots of Padres-Dodgers talk over the next few months because it's the rivalry that's going to define baseball. Just saw the list of the most popular jerseys in baseball. Four of the top five most sold jerseys in baseball are either Los Angeles Dodgers or San Diego Padres. Now, a lot of this has to do with the fact that Dodgers fans, much like Patriots fans in the NFL, always buy tons of jerseys for some reason. It's why Kike Hernandez is like the ninth most sold jersey in baseball, because people love Kike Hernandez, and now he's on the Red Sox. So that's a reason to buy his Dodgers jersey and a reason to buy his Red Sox jersey. Maybe not both by the same people, but still, lots of Kike Hernandez jerseys being sold. Four out of the top five most sold jerseys, San Diego Padres or Los Angeles Dodgers. So that rivalry is going to define baseball in a year that the Boston Red Sox are starting Nathan Eovaldi on opening day against Nathan Means of the Baltimore Orioles. And the Orioles have a genuine chance of actually beating Boston in Boston for the first series of the season, because both teams are going to be pretty pathetic in that American League East. Speaking of the American League East, the Yankees, of course, are far and away the favorites. So the only team you recognize that is good in the American League, and you know that they are not only good, they are great. You know that they're going to be deep in the playoffs. Everyone else is kind of a crapshoot. And maybe someone emerges from the pack. Maybe it's the White Sox. Maybe it's ends up being the Oakland Athletics, or maybe it's the Houston Astros, who, by the way, I still think are probably right up there in terms of prowess at this point. But who knows? There's so many different directions that this thing could end up going throughout the season. But specifically tomorrow, like, Houston has Zach Greinke still. And the Athletics, although it feels like they're shedding, like they lose Marcus Semien, they acquire Elvis Andrews, who, you know, that's a little bit of a downgrade, move off of Chris Davis from the Texas Rangers. It seems like they're in just this weird place as an organization right now for Oakland. But you look at the Central. You got the Twins, pretty good team. They haven't won a playoff game since 2002, 0-18. White, and they didn't change much of their team year over year. That's the other part. Chicago White Sox. We think the White Sox are good. We keep waiting for the White Sox to be good, but it looks like the White Sox are never actually good. And as we talked about on this show last year, when the White Sox went down to Oakland, it felt like the White Sox are just kind of in that mediocrity range right now. We'll see. You know, Cleveland is obviously going down, just traded Francisco Lindor from a team that got bounced early in the wild card last year. So you look around, and the only team we know definitively is good is the Yankees. Now, the thing is, teams always emerge time and time again out of the dust or whatever it may be over a long season. Like, someone will probably match the Yankees, maybe even have a better record than the Yankees, who we just weren't expecting. But they're somewhere in this pack between, you know, Tampa Bay, Houston, Oakland, the White Sox, the Twins. One of those teams maybe blossoms. Everyone's just kind of hedging right now because they don't really know who it's going to be and who we aren't evaluating as the best possible team. But someone may end up catching the Yankees. This happens all the time. But what's strange about it is that it hasn't happened recently in baseball, is that for the past five or so years, it's been Dodgers, it's been Astros, and it's been Yankees. And with the exception of the Padres this year, who are going to probably have to survive a one-game wild card to even advance to a full series, this year, again, feels like Dodgers, Yankees, and quite possibly the Astros. Because, again, the Houston Astros were one game away from the World Series just last October. And even if you subtract George Springer, and even if you subtract Gerrit Cole from last year, and even if you subtract Justin Verlander, who will miss all of this season, you still look at the Houston Astros and you don't see any way that anyone in the American League can catch the Houston Astros at their best, because they still have Altuve, still for now have Carlos Correa, still have Alex Bregman, return of Yordan Alvarez. They've had two really improved starters in Framber, or Frankie Valdez. Is it Framber or Frankie? One of them, Valdez and Jose Urquidy, who will replace the production that they've lost over the past couple of years. They already did some of that in the playoffs, so we'll see whether those two step up or if it's someone else. Maybe this is the Forrest Whitley year. Who knows? Maybe it all works out for Houston that way. But you look around and it's just the same teams at the top, which is weird in baseball because baseball is a sport that, you know, they have a lot of randomness, but they don't have a ton of parity because baseball has a soft salary cap, because there are genuine, even with revenue sharing, there are organizations with lots of money and organizations without lots of money because the regional TV contracts are negotiated independently. So you can genuinely have small market and big market teams. Now, the Padres, for example, were just recently sold. Well, not, I guess, sold to the minority owner, took over the majority stake. His name is Peter Seidler. He is now, the payroll is like fifth in Major League Baseball. You know, the Giants are always up, but they're going to be mediocre again. So there are a few examples that kind of like the Padres are trying to be a major team now, but it feels like the Padres are one of these teams that goes through cycles, like the Atlanta Braves, like the Philadelphia Phillies, like the Cleveland Indians from a couple years ago. Like, they just go through cycles year after year, and these are the natural things that happen in sports. Like, sometimes you have winning windows, and sometimes you don't have winning windows, unless you're the Yankees or the Red Sox. Well, the Red Sox are actually really messed up to not have a winning window all the time, but if you're the Yankees, who haven't had a losing season in 25 years, they used to be able to just have all the funds, and that's how they, you know, won three straight championships in the late 90s. But then when you had Cubs get sold to someone with equal financial standing, and the Red Sox, who could spend like the Yankees, when you had the Dodgers, who all of a sudden could spend like the Yankees, all of a sudden the Yankees' edge wasn't quite there anymore. They've been good, but they've won one championship in the last 20 years. So a lot of the edge was taken away from what Brian Cashman was doing with the Yankees. All of this is to say that the Yankees are still going to be good. The Dodgers are still going to be good. The Astros are still going to be good. And to be honest, if you look beyond that, it's a lot of who's who. And someone may pull away. I believe in my Padres. But again, if they don't beat the Dodgers, they're going to have a one-game playoff just to try and make it to the postseason. So that's going to be a little bit of an issue for them. But still, you look around, and you know what? Things could work out pretty well. Things could work out pretty well this season, even if you feel like you know who the best teams are. And look, there's a Tampa Bay that comes up, and maybe they'll take over there. And maybe it's, who knows, maybe it'll be the Braves' year this year, even though they were up 3-1 last year on the Dodgers. And it feels pretty certain that last year was Atlanta's best chance at winning a championship with this core of the team because everyone was healthy, because Freddie Freeman was the MVP of the sport. It felt like last year was just their year, and it didn't work out for them. And the Rays, kind of the same thing. The Rays feels like last year was kind of that year for Tampa Bay, but the Yankees, I mean, the Yankees are never healthy, but the Yankees for now are healthy, minus Luke Voit for now. So maybe this is just a precursor for bad things to happen for the Yankees. And then you have, of course, the Astros and, you know, this hodgepodge of teams that it feels like Tampa Bay is part of. And much like what we saw with, like, the White Sox and Twins last year, Tampa Bay could get bounced pretty early in the postseason or miss the postseason altogether, which would be kind of a shame. And, you know, Randy Arozarena, that thing fell apart real quick for Randy Arozarena, but still theoretically or still technically, according to service time, a rookie this year, even though he hit, what, 12 home runs in the playoffs last year, 11 home runs in the playoffs. Randy Arozarena, baby, that one fell apart fast. If you following his issue from this offseason, I don't know all the reporting behind it, but there was a issue with his child and things that seem strange in Randy Arozarena's life. But anyway, should be back, and we'll see what sustainability looks like for a guy who's now making $270,000 instead of $90,000 like he was a year ago. So we'll see how all that plays out for Tampa Bay, but they kind of feel like they're in that cast of characters right now. But again, we talked about the Dodgers-Padres thing earlier, and it's something that's generating a ton of excitement because, much like with Yankees-Red Sox, where everyone used to sit down, and Yankees-Red Sox games were like the three or four most rated broadcasts of the year, no matter how good the Yankees and Red Sox were. Now, the Red Sox are so bad that that won't be the case this year, is that the Dodgers and Padres have kind of filled that gap a little bit, is that They're the equivalent rivalry. There's some hatred there. There's some feuding. And as a Padres fan, we eat all that up. We're going to get so many nationally televised games this year, it's not even funny at this point. And so I'm excited to see what the Padres do, even if they aren't as good as the Dodgers. And the Dodgers are really good. I know we talked to our friend Bill Thompson at SB Nation, and he says that the Padres and Dodgers are kind of the equivalents of each other right now, and it's going to be really, really difficult to separate the two, and the Padres could end up winning the division after a long time, but still, it feels like everything is working in the way of the Padres because they've got real expectations, even if I know deep in my heart of hearts that they probably aren't better than the Dodgers. They might not even be better than the Atlanta Braves, but this is where you temper expectations and be pleasantly surprised. That's what I did last year, and the Padres pleasantly surprised me by having the second-best record in all of Major League Baseball, or I'm sorry, in all of the National League. I think it was like the fourth-best record in Major League Baseball, or fourth or third-best record in Major League Baseball. So it was a pleasant surprise last year. So maybe I'll be pleasantly surprised again this year. Maybe we can genuinely go on to win the World Series, and then I can have the moment of a lifetime when the Padres win the World Series. But, yeah, it should be interesting for a number of reasons beyond that if you're a Padres fan, of course. Like, you have expectations for the first time in, you know, however long. And Yu Darvish is starting opening day against Madison Bumgarner, which I do have to say for Major League Baseball. Like, I was thinking about this before we came on the air. Why didn't Major League Baseball put the Dodgers and the Padres on opening day? And I thought about this for a second. I was like, you know, why didn't MLB put Dodgers and Padres as their opening day game? And, you know, what came to me ultimately in the end was just either it's just randomizing of the schedules, it's a long season, you get only 18 of these things, so why put it in the first weekend? Unless you want to really drive up fan interest with a Dodgers-Padres game and maybe peak, and then people, you know, they get their fixings of baseball and then don't tune in later in the season. Maybe it's just the way that the schedule crumbled. Like, we're just going to have Rockies, Dodgers, and Padres against the Arizona Diamondbacks just because we're going to do that way. Who knows? But what I did find kind of interesting beyond that part is when I went back to think about it, I'm like, well, if you're going to market Dodgers and Padres, or if people are interested in Dodgers, Padres, and you want this to be like the ultimate indoctrination to the season. You can put Padres, Dodgers, prime time, whatever time it is, what, 7:10 on the they did put DeGrom and Scherzer, which they do that every year, and I have to say it's a great idea to keep pitting DeGrom against Scherzer on opening day. But if you're going to do that, you could do the prime time game of Dodgers versus the Padres. You could put Kershaw against Yu Darvish and have that whole thing. Could have been an interesting thing. And then the next series, you've got Darvish against Blake Snell, and then you've got Denelson Lamet versus Walker Buehler. Like, it would have been an awesome three-game series that we'll get at some point in the season. I just feel like to peak total interest, put the primetime game as the premier divisional matchup that everyone wants to see. And, yeah, Mets and Nationals is a great game, DeGrom and Scherzer. Again, they do it every year with DeGrom and Scherzer, and it's always awesome. Like, it's always awesome every single year. And still, I'm just like, yeah, so close, just so close to having that totally perfect. It would have been absolutely awesome to watch that. But ultimately, I don't think it's the end of the world for baseball. Like, if they – now, baseball may be getting close to the end of the world, but baseball – in a position where they are, Major League Baseball is definitely hoisting their leverage, per se, where they have all these games, they can put them at wherever they want, and even if it's like you want to put DeGrom and Scherzer as your nationally televised game, you'll save some Padres-Dodgers games for later in the season, like how they always saved Yankees-Red Sox. Now, it might have been fun to see Yankees-Red Sox, but maybe you're counting on those to be later dates of big ratings bonanzas. Who knows? Baseball's got a plan, I guess. Or it was just a random schedule error, and I'm totally overthinking it across 5 minutes. Possible, But I like to think of the other way better because it provides better content to talk about the Dodgers against my San Diego Padres, which I am so excited to watch that game tomorrow afternoon against the Diamondbacks and kick this season off with a bang because we've got expectations, ladies and gentlemen. The Padres have expectations for this season. I'll talk about DeGrom and Scherzer. That was actually another thing I wanted to talk about. Lucas Giolito for the White Sox, that's going to be great. Seeing Dylan Bundy as the opening day starter for the Angels, again, made me feel kind of sad because the Angels, I know Dylan Bundy was good last year, but the Angels just can't get any opening day starter of any kind of reasonably good ability or talent to play for their team. Or to bring up a prospect that might be able to help them. It's just been plaguing the Angels for much of Mike Trout's career, mediocrity, because they're always trying to be great, but they can never get the infrastructure around the great players, and just paying people at a certain time that reach free agency is not the most effective way. You need that with a complement of younger core players that can provide value, because as great as Anthony Rendon is, well, when you're paying him a whole hunk of change, he's not providing any value to you. So this is the difficulty that the Angels have been running into year after year. Same thing with Mike Trout now, is that Mike Trout is amazing and underpaid, but he's also the highest paid player in baseball. So the best he can do is win an MVP and according to, you know, best player in baseball, whatever it may be, he's equaling his market value considering he's the highest, he's paid to be the best player in baseball. And the Angels have, you know, because there's no salary cap in baseball, it's less so than the other sports, but you still need some sort of an infrastructure around these pieces, and this is the difficult thing that teams have to cope with and wrangle with every single year, is how do we find that balance in our budget, and how do we create value in these other places? And I guess Dylan Bundy is one of those, but Dylan Bundy should be like a third starter on a playoff team, not a number one starter. But hey, the Angels could make it out of that hodgepodge of teams in the American League, you know, like the Athletics, them, the Twins, the White Sox, Cleveland. Someone's got to win that division. I'm not sure who it's going to be between the three of those teams. The Royals are going to be better, but not good enough to make the playoffs. And then you've got in the AL East, the Rays. Oh, I didn't even mention the Blue Jays. The Blue Jays play the Yankees opening day. They still got Hyunjin Ryu playing Garrett Cole. Those are the two biggest free agents from a couple, you know, couple free agent classes ago, 2019, winter of 2020. Last time we saw Hyunjin Ryu, he was getting lit up by the Tampa Bay Rays to knock Toronto home. And Toronto's, like, we talked about this when George Springer signed on the radio show, like, Toronto is, like, the most forgettable team in terms of, like, they made the playoffs last year, but nobody remembers that they made the playoffs. It's, like, them and, like, Cincinnati or Milwaukee. It's, like, yeah, they made the playoffs because of the change in the way this thing, the way we do the schedule and the, you know, expanded playoffs for one season that I don't understand why is not a full-time expanded playoffs. But anyways, it's still really intriguing to watch Arizona and the Padres and the Blue Jays and the Yankees and Cleveland and Detroit and Baltimore and Boston and Minnesota play Milwaukee with Brandon Woodruff, still the number one starter in Milwaukee. But the Brewers are very aggressively not spending money. So the Brewers may fade to the background at this point. There's a, you know, a non-zero chance that they finish fourth in the American League or in the National League Central if the Cincinnati Reds can actually get some offense this year, because last year was pathetic the last time that we saw Cincinnati playing baseball. By the way, they play the Cardinals tomorrow with Castillo versus Flaherty. This is just kind of a side note from something that went on over the offseason. I really want to see that Carlos Correa for Luis Castillo swap, because we don't see that very often anymore. It's, you know, teams playing for needs, teams trading for stars and giving out big contracts. I think both teams would be making a poor decision to make the trade, but imagine getting Carlos Correa for 8 years and you give up this future of Luis Castillo, this amazing starter, and you're taking away from your depth to add to your offense. But again, I think a starting pitcher might hold more value, but also Luis Castillo probably has a lesser chance of blossoming into a superstar than Carlos Correa. It's just, it's really difficult to process that. I'm sure that Cincinnati would get other stuff as well as Carlos Correa, but that swap, like, you don't hear those things being discussed very often. I don't know how that story got leaked or where the information came from, but we just don't hear those stories very often. So it was just fun to see that story pop up. Also, Matthew Boyd, still a Detroit Tiger. It's always baffling to see that happen year in, year out, just to see Matthew Boyd still playing for around the Detroit Tigers. After he should have been traded like probably two deadlines ago at this point, and then the pandemic happened, and now Matthew Boyd, a Detroit Tiger, starting opening day for the third consecutive season for the godly awful Detroit Tigers. We can laugh at this too. Who else are the awful opening day starters tomorrow? We got Chad Kuhl for the Pittsburgh Pirates, and who's starting for Colorado? Let's figure out who's starting for the Rockies against the Dodgers. They have, oh, Herman Marquez. He's still there. Nice. Kansas City's got that Keller guy who people think is really good, but I've never actually watched him pitch. But I also hadn't seen Lucas Giolito pitch until last year, and now that man is the Cy Young frontrunner in the American League. So, you know, just because I haven't seen him play is an indictment of just Royals baseball. I haven't watched a Royals game in about 2 years, so I just haven't watched Keller pitch. But that name is just one that it's funny to just read on the probables for tomorrow. I ruined the best joke right off the bat, which is that there's an opening day matchup in – sorry, car went through there. I don't know if you guys could hear that, but there's an opening day matchup tomorrow in Boston, a national holiday of opening day between John Means and Nathan Eovaldi for the terrible Orioles and the terrible Red Sox, which I think by far has to be the worst matchup of the day, and this is on a day – because all of the other teams, I don't think there's any, like, two bad matchups. I guess Kevin Gausman plays Marco Gonzalez between the Giants and the Mariners. That one's another funny one. I'm still stunned that Kevin Gausman is still a San Francisco Giant. Like, that is a prospect waiting to be moved for San Francisco and Seattle. They just didn't pull the trigger on that trade. But I guess market inefficiencies kind of swing the other way. When the value is down and prospects become more valuable, then maybe keeping a Kevin Gausman is a way to exploit some market inefficiencies. It's probably the same reason why Matthew Boyd is still a Detroit Tiger after all this time, is that at a certain point, the market inefficiencies swing back the other way. When, you know, when Moneyball happens, all of a sudden you're trying to get prospects because teams don't value them enough, and Miguel Cabrera is getting traded for two of the best prospects in baseball, like two of the top five prospects in baseball. And now Nolan Arenado in a dump is getting four like mid-level prospects going back to Colorado. But when things swing the other way, then the market, sometimes the market efficiency might be to just keep your player and collect the wins above replacement until maybe their value goes up and teams are ready to spend, which maybe Kevin Gausman is one of those deadline acquisitions this year. And maybe this is the year Matthew Boyd gets traded, which is starting to sound a lot like maybe this is the year Brooke Lopez gets traded, which the Brooklyn Nets were doing for like three seasons. It's like maybe this is when Brooke Lopez finally gets traded. This is the deadline that he gets traded, but maybe not. This is now year three for Matthew Boyd. We'll see if he's still in Detroit playing for the crappy Detroit Tigers at the end of the season, because the Tigers are really, really bad and don't have much hope of going up anytime soon. But hey, welcome to opening day, Detroit. At least you can watch some of these interesting players for your team, like Johan Camargo, I'm pretty sure is still on the, or is now on the Detroit Tigers, if I'm not mistaken. Well, let's play this game. Who's on the Detroit Tigers now? They've got a guy named Buck Farmer as one of their best pitchers. Let's see. Of course, Boyd, Casey Mize, that should be fun. Daniel Norris, still a Detroit Tiger. They've got Wilson Ramos now. This is the last stop of Wilson Ramos's path to retirement or overseas. By the time you land in Detroit as a free agent, that's kind of the sign that your career is on the down low. Let's see who else they got here. Heimer Candelario is there. Oh, Nico Goodrum, you can get excited about him. He's actually pretty good. Dad's Cameron, people have high hopes for him. Born in 1997, by the way, getting closer to my age. Jacoby Jones was there for a hot minute last year when the Tigers were the 8th seed in the playoffs for about not six weeks. The season was only like 10 weeks. So that was probably, 3 weeks that Jacoby Jones was an all-star and they were the 8th seed before everything just totally fell apart for Detroit. That sounds about right. So, hey, maybe Jacoby Jones has something left in the tank. And you got Daz Cameron and Robbie Grossman and Nomar Mazara coming off the bench, which, by the way, if you go from Texas to the White Sox to Detroit, you are on your way out of the league, Nomar Mazara. But, hey, good luck to the Detroit Tigers this year. You've got just no chance of being good, but, hey, you can get excited about Jose Ureña and Julio Teheran and Michael Fulmer and Daniel Norris and the water buffalo Wilson Ramos. So good luck to the crappy Detroit Tigers for the 2021 Major League Baseball season. Whew. My throat always feels weird after we do this for an hour, but not like it hurts. It just feels like my windpipe is just like a deflated balloon at a certain point. It just feels weird in my throat. All right. Let's talk about this NFL trade for a little bit, because we've gone through, what does it mean for San Francisco? Well, they're drafting a quarterback. What quarterback? We're not sure which quarterback it's going to end up being. What does this mean for Miami? Well, Miami had a ton of first-round picks, but they wanted one that was higher up in the draft. They saved their pick, or they took their picks, moved up to number 6. They're keeping San Francisco's over the next couple of years, which, again, they've now collected close to 5 first-round picks in exchange for Laremy Tunsil. Close to 5 first-round picks for Laremy Tunsil. The Dolphins had the first-round pick last year, which they drafted Noah, I don't know his name, but it starts with an I. Cannot pronounce that name at all. But first-round pick from Houston last year. They got this year's number 3 pick, which they flipped into 3 first-round picks, including the one from San Francisco, and the second-round pick. That is basically a first-round pick because it's the number 34 pick, so you're getting first-round value at second-round prices. So they basically got 5 first-round picks out of the Laremy Tunsil deal. They moved back to 6. They used 2 of those 5 picks to get to number 6, so really it's like 4 picks. And Philadelphia Eagles end up going down to number 12, which Eagles fans, it's a good move. You needed the extra draft pick, but you guys are going to have to look at some graphics for the next however many years it's going to be. You're going to have to see some graphics with you guys and which player you gave up in this trade and which player you ended up getting in this trade that could end up being almost as haunting as drafting Jalen Reagor 1 pick before Justin Jefferson last year. And we already know that that's bad, and that was we knew that after 4 games. So that's just on you for messing that one up, but a lot of people messed that up. To be fair, a lot of people messed that one up. Jalen Reagor does 800 push-ups. The problem is Carson Wentz, but also Justin Jefferson looks so good, even with just being a wide receiver, too, and breaking all these receiving records. Justin Jefferson looks unbelievable. The Eagles, I will never criticize a team for trading down in the draft because ultimately teams will pay a hefty price for valuable picks. The Eagles ended up netting an extra first-round pick, and they did a pick swap where they moved down a few picks in the third and the fourth round. So be it. It's a fine and dandy move by the Philadelphia Eagles to move down in the NFL draft and get that extra first-round pick from the Dolphins. And the Eagles will take whoever they take. It might be a defensive player. I think that's kind of the sign that you're giving when you move down that far in the draft and anticipating that, I think no defensive players will be taken in at least the first 8 picks of the draft. That's a very real possibility. 9 picks, you could even say. The Cowboys will probably be the first defensive player drafted. The Giants could take wide receivers. So by that point, all of the wide receivers could be gone. I think the Eagles are probably pick of their litter on defensive players. Do you want Caleb Farley? Patrick Surtain might be available. Do you want Micah Parsons? Do you want Jalen Phillips? Do you want Gregory Rousseau? They're kind of probably just pick their best defensive player available over there in the draft. So that should be interesting to watch. But the 49ers side of things is interesting, and the Falcons side of things is interesting, which we haven't really dove into the Falcons side of things yet when evaluating this trade, because the Atlanta Falcons are in this interesting place where now they theoretically control the draft. I said this before with Sam Darnold. It's like the Jets don't have to be transparent or don't have to be 100% like scheming. Like the Jets, you control the draft. You know Trevor Lawrence is going to be the number one pick in the draft. So just take Trevor Lawrence off your board and just start the draft process from there. You have the first pick. You control the board. And now we know the Jets are going to take Zach Wilson, which all of a sudden, once we had that basically confirmed, then Miami controls the draft board. And that's when San Francisco decided, hey, we'd like to control the draft board. So San Francisco moves up to number 3 in a shocking trade over the weekend. That was one thing where I think the only thing I yelled more about was about Nikola Vukovic ending up in Chicago, where I was like, what? And then I saw San Francisco. I was just like, what? How is that even possible? And so San Francisco wants to control the board. They're obviously picking one of these quarterbacks. We just don't know which one it's going to be. Maybe we'll know by next week which one it's going to end up being. But San Francisco is going to pick one of these quarterbacks, which means now the Falcons control the draft board. And the Falcons want transparency, but they don't have to once they decide they're going to keep the pick. The Falcons don't have to hide who they're going to take because they know who the first 3 picks are going to be. It's Trevor Lawrence, it's Zach Wilson, and it's whoever the 49ers draft at quarterback. So you take those 2 off the board and you wait to see who the 49ers pick before you pick your person. And maybe they have their own big board of quarterbacks, and they're saying if it gets to, you know, if our guy gets taken at 3, then we'll pick someone else. Like we'll pick Penei Sewell or we'll pick Kyle Pitts, which I see his combine tape today came out, and they're saying like this dude is Calvin Johnson, but at tight end, which I was saying before, everyone wants a DK Metcalf. Everyone wants a Chase Claypool, and that's what Kyle Pitts is coming out of this draft. Put him at wide receiver. I mean, just put Kyle Pitts at slot receiver and see what happens. The man runs a 4.46. Like, let's just put him in there and see what ends up happening with Kyle Pitts. And so this is the interesting thing for the Falcons is that you don't have to be anything, but you don't have to be transparent. You can be pretty much just totally honest who you're going to pick, because nobody has the power over you except the 49ers if they take the only quarterback that you want. Now, if that ends up being the case, that they take the only quarterback that you wanted, well, that changes the game a little bit, because now you're looking around and you're saying to yourself, okay, so what do we want from, for example, Penei Sewell, or if someone wants to take a quarterback, like say the Panthers don't want to be left with whoever the last person is, even if the last person might be, that might be the best option, is taking all the decision out of it and just letting whoever falls to you fall to you at 8 and picking that quarterback. Like if you are the Panthers, you're looking around and you're saying, we want to be able to dictate who we get, and so we want to trade with the Falcons. And the Falcons are like, well, there's a division premium that you need, and by the way, we're thinking of X quarterback if the 49ers are taking Y quarterback. So this is where the Falcons do have a point where they kind of want to be transparent about it, but you control the draft board now. And the Bengals at 5, if you know who the Falcons are going to take, you control the draft board now. And so this is one of those rare times where usually, I said this last year, where you know who the first 2 picks, and really the first 3 picks in the draft were going to be last year. You knew this was going to be Joe Burrow. You knew the second pick was going to be Chase Young. You kind of knew the third pick was going to be Jeff Okuda. So at that point, and there was not as many like talented prospects this year, but then you look up and you say, okay, Giants, you control the board. You control your destiny. You control your fate. Do you want to trade with someone who's interested in getting Tua or Justin Herbert? Do you want to pick a player yourself? Who's the best available player if you take those three guys off your draft board? Who is your best available player? The Giants ultimately took Andrew Thomas, which was one of the worst possible decisions you could make, not with any indictment on Andrew Thomas, but because, in hindsight, you could have traded down, you could have picked Isaiah Simmons, and you could have done something other than picking the fourth best left tackle in the first round of the draft last year. Even if you were going to pick left tackle, there was like three other options that you could have picked that would have been better than Andrew Thomas. Maybe Andrew Thomas will turn it around, but maybe he'll be a fine left tackle, and that's kind of all you can ask for. But it's just it's the way when you leave value on the table like that, it's the way that teams end up being like the Giants, where they've done the rebuild correctly. They made the necessary trades to set the rebuild in motion. They just drafted Saquon at 2, Daniel Jones at 6, Andrew Thomas at 4, and DeAndre Baker at 30. That's just how the cookie crumbled for the New York Giants. So this leaves an interesting position for, because similar to last year, you control the draft board, and possibly Cincinnati, you control the draft board after that. So we'll see where it goes, because at a certain point, teams at the top of the draft board don't have to be transparent anymore. It's how we knew that, you know, for example, Joe Burrow is going to be number one, Chase Young is going to be number two, because those teams weren't necessarily super transparent about the process. And they didn't need to be, because they, what's their incentive to be, you know, transparent about the, to hide, what's their reasoning to hide what they're going to do? When you control the draft board, you can pick whoever you want, why do you have to keep things a secret? For other teams, who cares what other teams are doing? Your team is doing X, and so you don't have to hide X from Team A or Team B or Team C or Team D. Like, you're doing what you're doing, and those are your incentives. It's just way – it's way overcomplicating way too much. So now the Falcons control the draft board. Now that Miami controlled the draft board by knowing the Jets were going to take Zach Wilson, kind of an open secret at this point that the Jets are going to take Zach Wilson. And so the third pick – Miami decided to move swiftly once they control the draft board, is that, hey, so we know Wilson's going to be number two. Who wants the number three pick? San Francisco comes in and say, we'd like to control the draft board and trade a lot of our future to control the draft board. So they do that. And now the Falcons control the draft board, because we know pick one, you know pick two, you know pick three. You know they're going to take quarterback, even if you don't know the quarterback itself. So now Atlanta controls the draft board. And sooner or later, maybe, just maybe, the Cincinnati Bengals will control the draft board. But for the Falcons, I think transparency is key. Unless you have decided you are going to take a quarterback, no matter who the 49ers take at pick three, or you've decided that you're going to trade down in the draft, make the trade as quickly as possible. No need to wait till draft day. You control the board just like the Dolphins did. Make the trade as soon as you have the trade that you want. Go ahead and have someone make you an offer that you can't refuse and do the trade now, because Atlanta, you are on the clock. So from the rest of that trade, I think there's a lot to unpack about, you know, San Francisco, what they're trying to do, and whether or not Jimmy Garoppolo will be there. I think we don't have the answers. If you want speculation, you can go somewhere else for the speculation. It's fine. It's going to be interesting to watch it all play out, though, over the next, you know, less than a month now. It's like 4 weeks out from the NFL draft. So it'll be interesting, no doubt. I'm going to be piqued interest about how all of this will play out from a San Francisco, Miami, and Philadelphia standpoint, as well as everyone else, because I assume sooner or later Miami will be back on the clock again. They were on the clock at pick three. Sooner or later, they'll be back on the clock at pick six, assuming that they kind of know what everyone's going to do, similar to how it was last year, where it was pretty transparent what these teams are going to do from the whispers and where there's smoke, there's fire idea. With obviously Trevor Lawrence, there's literally a fire, because they basically admitted as much about Trevor Lawrence The number two pick, the Jets, we know they're taking a quarterback now, which is why I'm surprised they haven't traded Sam Darnold yet, because his value is only going down if they're entirely sold on picking a quarterback, which it seems pretty clear that they are. I'm surprised that they haven't just gone for it. We don't have enough information, so we'll pass on the speculation. Again, we've done that a little bit on the podcast. You can check it out. Take It Easy Podcast, wherever it is that you get podcasts. We did that on Monday, a little bit today on Wednesday's podcast that you can check out. But there's a lot of stuff there, a lot of intrigue. We'll see how it plays out. So with that being said, let's switch over into March Madness mode a little bit, because this is the end of March Madness. This weekend will be the Final Four. The championship is on Monday. And ultimately, almost everything corrected itself in the end. Michigan ended up falling to UCLA last night in, like I said, a 51-49 just snooze fest of a basketball game. But still, when you put stakes behind it, of course I'm going to watch it. And that's the thing I've said with college basketball all year. If you put stakes behind these games, I'm going to watch it. It's why everyone got super into that Baylor-UConn game on Monday in women's basketball, where there was a double elbow foul situation, and Gino Auriemma and Kim Mulkey and LeBron James are at center of all of it. And, you know, it's one of the highest rated women's basketball games on ESPN in, I think, a couple of years, going back to the last time UConn lost in the Final Four. So all of that is, you know, obviously super intriguing and everyone's into that. But the basic point of it is, when you put stakes behind something, people are going to tune in. People are going to get excited by it. And even the UCLA-Michigan game, on the tips of my toes, because it was a close game and the last 2 minutes were just a super intriguing duel back and forth. Now, were there a lot of slow-paced missed buckets before that? Was Johnny Juzang scoring, I think, what, 28 of UCLA's 51 points? Yeah, he was. And it was absolutely heroic to see how that one played out. And Johnny Juzang was amazing for UCLA, and Michigan had nothing to counter with, no buckets. They had Franz Wagner, which is Moritz Wagner's brother, and they had Simpson, and you know, that was the end. That was the end for Michigan, and everything else kind of fell in line. And we talked about that on today's podcast with Gonzaga and Baylor and Houston. A lot of it fell into line, minus the Loyola Chicago upset of Illinois. Houston ended up coasting after they almost lost to Rutgers, which would have started chaos in the Midwest. And this is something that we talked about on the podcast the week before, is that we were one upset away from chaos in the East region, the Midwest region, and the South region. Ultimately, the South region did not get their upset following the round of 32. The Midwest region was about to get their upset in being down double digits against Rutgers with 7 minutes left before they had a comeback and won that game to stay alive in the tournament. That would have been the chaos that set that bracket ablaze. And UCLA got the chaos by beating Alabama in the Sweet 16. That's where chaos ensued in that region. And they took another upset to create utter chaos to knock off Michigan and advance to the Final Four. So ultimately, out of the three regions we were talking about, we got chaos in one of those regions. And technically, we were getting closer to chaos in the West region, because even though Gonzaga was never tested, Iowa lost real early in that tournament. Iowa got bounced early by Oregon in, I think that was on what? That would have been The Tuesday of March Madness last week was Iowa getting bounced real early. But again, Gonzaga was never tested, so no chaos in that region. Even though USC did make an Elite Eight run, they got smacked by Gonzaga yesterday. Score was, after the referee collapsed on the court, the score was like 25-8. So that was a smacking by Gonzaga on USC, and that was kind of just the theme for Gonzaga. Never tested, won by 40-plus in their first game, dominated Oklahoma by like 17, beat Creighton by 20 points, beat USC by, I think it was like 17, but they were up 17 like 13 minutes into that game. So just domination by Gonzaga. They're probably the favorites to win the whole, or they are the favorites to win the whole thing. They're probably going to win the whole thing if I'm pretty sold on this. But again, we'll know all the information by the time next Wednesday rolls around. So it's going to be interesting when we tune back in on the Take It Easy radio show to see what goes on between Gonzaga and between the Zags and USC, and all of that is going to be interesting to watch play out across the next month or so. Or not, I'm sorry, the next week or so. I guess it's a month because theoretically March ends in about 11 hours. So theoretically it could be a month, but what I meant to say, I misspoke, is about a week. So we are coming up on the end of the show here. Let's see if there's any breaking news to react to here on the podcast. Before opening day, George Springer has a grade 2 strain of his left oblique, and so George Springer is headed to the IL. we talked about George Springer on this podcast when he signed his free agent deal back in February, I want to say first week of February, and I said, trying to find some way to spin this story, but then I just looked at it and said, this doesn't really matter that much in the grand scheme of things for the American League East. And so I was looking at George Springer as like, hey, this is a fun move. He's going to be there. They're paying him $25 million to fill their leadoff spot for the next few years, and now all of a sudden it is really – it is really such that they really don't matter anymore for the Toronto Blue Jays, because they won't have George Springer, at least for the first like 2 weeks of the season, if he's headed to the IL. Tough break for the Blue Jays the day before opening day. Also, the Washington Nationals have a positive COVID-19 test. One player tested positive, and there's five that are in close contact. Ooh, let's see what this story is. There are five players are going to miss opening day. I guess we'll find out. This is the second year in a row that this happened for the Nationals, because last year, I remember, it was like Starlin Castro was the three-hitter for the defending World Series champions. And so five players are going to quarantine. They'll be gone. And there will be roster moves and the traveling squad and all of that stuff. There were only 17 – wow. There were only 17 positive tests during spring training, which – I guess, to be fair, a lot of the vaccinations are helping with that. I don't know which Major League Baseball players are vaccinated or not, but it seems to be kind of the theme as we start to exit COVID-19 after, 14 months, everyone getting worn out all the way through, as I know I've been worn out by COVID-19 over the last year or so. But this seems to be the theme is that if you haven't got it by now, you probably already, you're probably not going to get it again, but also a large segment of the population can get it multiple times. Like, this isn't something that just, you get it once and you're immune. We've seen that when people have gotten it a number of times so far, sometimes even up to three now. It should be interesting to watch for Washington again for what, the second time in a row? Second year in a row that Washington's just going to have nobody on opening day. Maybe Juan Soto will be back, but Washington, is Washington going to be better than Miami? I guess that's too far down the road to ask the question, but, I think the Mets are probably the best team in the division, or I'm sorry, the Braves are the best team in the division, and then the Mets and the Phillies. So I guess Washington's kind of that fourth team right now where they're like, they've got Juan Soto, but they kind of need to rebuild a little bit. And they kind of needed to get healthy. They had just really bad luck last year with injuries and replacing Rendon and Strasburg's bad contract, which they probably should have paid Rendon over Strasburg, even though I know I know that Anthony Rendon didn't really want to be a Washington National any longer, so he ended up going to Anaheim. But it doesn't make the Strasburg contract any more painful for Washington, that they lost him for pretty much all of last year, and they're hoping to get him back healthy this year. I actually don't know if Strasburg is healthy and ready to go for opening day this year. But Strasburg ready for season. All right, there's the answer. So Strasburg is ready to go after missing pretty much all of last season. So went to 98 pitches in the spring training finale. So, yeah, Steven Strasburg is ready to go, ladies and gentlemen. So there you go. He is healthy, but, again, I was saying they're probably better than the Marlins, but, you know, Washington kind of, I mean, again, things can change. The Mets could suck. The Phillies could suck. The Nationals could, you know, Juan Soto could win MVP for all we know. But it feels like Washington is kind of in that, like, fourth or fifth place tier of the National League East, and having this COVID situation isn't going to hurt him as much as last year where they lost Juan Soto for 2 out of the 10 weeks of the season. But still sucks to kick off the season that way if you're Washington, because they kind of need all the help they can get at this point. So I feel like also we're just kind of numb to COVID outbreaks at this point. It's just kind of like part of the game at the – or not part of the game, just part of life at this point. Because I remember when the first Marlins one happened and everyone was, you know, kind of flipping about that one. But, I mean, it was 19 people also because there wasn't really a lot of contact tracing being done or preventing of, you know, this outbreak from happening. But, you know, close contact isn't necessarily positive cases. So we've gotten a little bit more meticulous, and we've been doing it for so long that we've gotten better about it. And COVID is slowly but steadily becoming one of the last issues pressing America at this point, or at least a certain segment of America, as life just becomes adjusted. After 13 months, it's impossible to adjust to whatever it is that has gone on. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for stopping in to the Take It Easy radio show, Radio 313 The Flash. Again, follow Open Talk Radio wherever it is that you get, follow the podcast wherever it is you get podcasts. Follow Open Talk Radio on Blog Talk, Facebook, Instagram, if you're looking for more content coming out here. I know that our General Hospital show was earlier, I think yesterday, actually. It was a cool episode. I checked that out. So check out all the cool stuff on Open Talk Radio as well. And follow us at Comical Sports Memes. And for now, Take It Easy Podcast on Instagram if you want some full stuff, as well as just subscribing to the podcast. It's always the best way to find podcast information. If you like memes and content like that, of course, you can check out our Instagram as well. That's just a fun place for some alternative content as well. Because again, that's the platform that allows us to create this podcast with 331 ratings on Apple Podcasts, most of them 5 stars, but not all of them. And it allows us to, you know, get all of these lovely reviews and 331 ratings on Apple Podcasts. And so all of it is hugely, hugely appreciated for that support. And the reason we're able to do that is because of all the great followers over on Comical Sports Memes and why we have this platform of a radio show. So thank you to everyone. We appreciate you stopping in here today. As always, take it easy. One more thing, by the way, we are excited for opening day and excited to continue our partnership here, but ultimately we are just thankful that you tuned into the show. So thank you so much, and take it easy.